So this is Dixie Noonan, and I'm here for the interview of Kevin McGinn of AIG, and I'm just going to have everybody go around the room, starting with Sarah.
Sarah Knaus.
You want to say who you're with?
FCIC.
Stacey Nettlefin, Wild Gotchel, on behalf of AIG.
Chris Miratello, Wilkie Farr and Gallagher, on behalf of Kevin McGinn.
Evelyn Conget, Wilkie Farr and Gallagher.
Mike Young, Wilkie.
And Kevin McGinn.
Al Crago, FCIC.
And Chris Seifer with the FCIC, and just for the record, note that it's June 10th, 2010.
Thank you. And Mr. McGinn, thanks again for coming today. I'm sure that your counsel has told you a little bit about the commission. Just to give you an overview, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is a bipartisan commission that was established by Congress in May of last year to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. The reason we've asked you here today is because one of the roles of the commission is looking into institutions that failed or would have failed, but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. AIG falls into that category. We are also looking at the role of complex financial derivatives in the financial crisis and are specifically interested in the role that those played and credit default swaps particularly played in AIG's problems. So with that said, I just would like to get you to give us a description of your history at AIG.
Sure.
And to the extent you could, a brief description of your employment before AIG and educational background.
Sure. I'll start with the education. I'm a graduate of College of Fordham University in New York. I did my MBA work at New York University, and I have also a master's in economics from Fordham University, where I also did some doctoral work. I was a banker I'm an ex-Peace Corps volunteer, from 1973, I joined Marie Millen Bank, which became part of HSBC. I was with them for about 17 years. Worked as chief credit officer of Bank Austria Credit Anstalt in New York.
Bank Austria, I'm sorry?
Bank Austria, that's enough.
Okay.
They merged with Credit Anstalt, which is another Austrian bank. Became the head of lending for that institution. I joined AIG in 1999 as a credit executive for the international side, and in July of 2004 was appointed chief credit officer of AIG.
And that's a position you still hold today?
I do indeed.
What is a credit executive on the international side? What exactly did those? What was your job description there?
I was responsible for approving and monitoring all our credit exposures on the international side of AIG. Predominantly, I was responsible for our AIA unit, which is our Southeast Asian unit, and for several of our businesses, our insurance businesses that have international operations. We have a company which today is known as Chartis International, which at that point was known as AIU, which has issues such products as surety bonds, trade credit insurance, political risk insurance, does captive insurance for large multinational companies, and I was responsible for those credit exposures. The way it worked was that we had credit officers in the business units. They had certain delegated authorities, and above those authorities, transactions had to come up to the credit risk management department of the holding company, and I was then responsible for approving those, as well as monitoring the ongoing credit developments in the company and the international side.
So on the international side, would that have included AIG Financial Products in London and Banque AIG in France?
No, not at that point. That was handled by another officer. From time to time, I would be brought into some corporate credits in Europe for approval as a second signature, but no, I was not handling that at all at that time.
Who would that person have been?
The department reported to Bob Lewis, who at that time was the chief credit officer of AIG, who today is the chief risk officer of AIG. And the primary credit executive handling FP at that point was a man named John Weibel.
How do you spell his last name?
W-I-B-E-L.
So what exactly does the role of a chief credit officer entail for AIG parent company?
The credit risk management department of the holding company is sort of like the executive body of the credit risk committee. And the credit risk committee is comprised, and of which the credit chief credit officer chairs that committee. And the, in a sense, it's sort of the executive body for the credit risk committee. So it's responsible for, I was chairman of that committee, so I chaired the committee meetings. That committee essentially approves policies of AIG's credit policies, approves delegated limits to credit officers around the company, and it monitors the ongoing portfolio developments, if you will. We run a series of what we call CRC portfolio reviews, where each business unit comes in and we do a complete review of the credit exposures of that particular company.
How often does that take place?
About once a year. And there are we do about 50 of those a year. So it's a pretty formidable list at the time. In addition to that, as I mentioned earlier, if certain exposures, large exposures, come above the delegated authority of the business units, we have to approve those as well. And I will sit and review those approvals with the credit committee.
Kevin, so it might even be helpful to back up just one step and explain sort of credit risk as opposed to the other kinds of risks that are handled elsewhere in the RM.
I don't know how far back we want to go, but there were really two principal departments, and maybe I should step back even further. The decision to form an enterprise risk management decision was not made until July of 2004, and at that point the decision was made to form a department and to bring three different disciplines into that department, one being the credit group, which was perhaps the longest standing function, having been started by Bob Lewis, in fact, in 1993, and then the market risk department. And in fact, then to develop a third risk management set, a discipline, if you will, which is called operational risk management at the holding company. That would take place, we would go out and hire a head of operational risk, a man named John Simone, and that would take place during the course of the next year to year and a half. So we brought in those three disciplines into the ERM department. And at the same time that this decision was made, I was appointed chief credit officer by Hank Greenberg, the then chief executive officer of AIG, replacing Bob Lewis, but reporting to Bob Lewis.
I was actually going to ask when in 2004 that you became chief credit officer.
I want to say the exact date is about July 17th of 2004, something around that time.
Okay.
That's probably that's a matter of public record. You could look that up. I think there's actually something that we put out, a press release we put out at that time. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I ask you a quick question? The liquidity component, would that discipline have been managed out of the operations risk discipline or the market risk discipline?
Neither.
So
ERM at that point was not responsible for liquidity risk management.
Did it ever become responsible?
Starting in, I can't give you the exact date there, but I want to say starting sometime in the spring of 2008.
And before that, who would have been responsible for that?
It was my understanding that the treasurer of the company was most responsible for that. At that time, it would have been Bob Gender.
So at the time that you became the chief credit officer...
Actually, I'm sorry, hold on. So at the time Bob Gender is in the spring of 2008, he becomes in charge of liquidity risk management?
No, I was going to say that my understanding was that liquidity risk management was really Bob's domain.
He was the treasurer.
He was the treasurer.
Yeah, during the 04, 05.
Right, but then sometime in 08, it does the responsibility for liquidity risk management becomes the... an ERM function, if you will, reporting to Bob Lewis.
It's still sort of a shared responsibility.
It is. It is between the two, yeah.
Was there some reason that in the spring of 2008 that change occurred?
I mean, I think it had a lot to do, frankly, with the collateral calls associated with the credit default swaps up at FP.
Okay.
Or certainly, certainly that was a contributing cause, let's put it that way.
So the chief credit officer, would that always have been a function within risk management? Was it perceived as a risk management function?
We had long-standing departments, one for credit risk management, of course, which I was originally hired to, and market risk management. They were two sort of independent departments, and what happened in 2004 was they were merged. You know, they were merged under a single a chief risk officer, because at that point we never had a chief risk officer, and that happened in that July 04 period.
So before 2004 there was no chief risk officer?
No.
And when you became the chief credit officer, you said that Bob Lewis became the chief risk officer,
right. He was promoted to chief risk officer, and I in turn replaced him as chief credit officer.
And so did you report to Bob Lewis as
yes.
chief? Do you still report to him?
I do.
And he's still the chief risk officer? You were talking about the credit department monitoring exposures. What types of exposures? Are these counterparty exposures? Are they
Well, they're credit exposures. I guess you would think of them as counterparty exposures. They're credit exposures of any and all kinds. The bond portfolio, the fixed income bond portfolio, is probably the biggest single part of the credit portfolio of AIG. Any bond portfolio or loan portfolios, by definition, are credit exposures, lease portfolios. We have a financial lease company as well down in Dallas, an equipment leasing company. And any credit exposures for counterparty risk, you might think of, you know, our exposures, for example, our mark-to-market exposures against JP Morgan or whatever would also be included in that. We'd also wrap up under that letters of credit that we had received as collateral for insurance programs that we may have our customers may have given us as security against their programs. Reinsurance recoverables would be when we give seed reinsurance, as they call it, to a reinsurer on some of our casualty and property coverages.
What about deposits
would be another typical thing that you would expect, or the cash that we have would be, that we could replace with J.P. Morgan or Citibank. Or
sure. What about exposures to specific sectors? Would that be more of a market risk function than a credit risk function?
Well, no. I would say we certainly follow the sectoral exposures of the company without question. Yes, definitely, we're responsible for that.
Okay. And you said that before you became chief credit officer in July 2004, you did not have a relationship or any responsibility over AIG FP. Is that right?
I did not. Only to the extent that they might have a credit exposure in some of the Asian markets or some of the markets that I was responsible for, some of the European corporates I would be responsible for, but nothing for... Where I think you're going is things like credit default swaps or anything like that.
So could you describe how you became responsible, if at all, over FP starting in July of 2004 and what your involvement was in that business and in monitoring
sure.
it going forward?
Yeah, like every other business of the company, FP had a certain delegated credit authority that was defined, had a number of metrics that they had to comply with. We have our own risk rating system, and generally credit authorities are allocated based upon what we call grid-based limits, where if something is rated a AAA in our system, they're allowed to do up to X amount of dollars. If it's a AA, it's a lower amount, A, and it goes down the line. FP essentially would have to send down to, like every other unit, would have to send down requests for credit approvals for things that exceeded those authorities, that their own credit team were not permitted to approve just on their own. And so that's how I would interact with them. in that regard. Now, you know, on a day-to-day level, most of the responsibility was handled by John Weiler. But I did, obviously, monitor pretty closely.
And then you said you did annual portfolio reviews.
And we did annual portfolio reviews.
Wouldn't that have included the FP unit?
It would include the FP unit, absolutely.
What about the securities lending business? Mm-hmm. Would you also have done an annual portfolio review of the securities lending?
Yes, we did. We did an annual review of the counterparties to that program, as well as to the some of the RMBS securities and other, what we would do actually around the investment department was we would conduct portfolio reviews around the different kinds of sectors that you were talking about earlier. So they would come to us and review with us CMBS, RMBS portfolios, CDOs, anything that they did in the structured product area, as well as high yield, leveraged loans, any particular sectors that we, and we would raise questions, express concerns, those kinds of things.
Okay.
Same kind of delegated authorities in the
same kind of delegated
business.
Authorities. Yeah.
And I take it the delegated authorities are written down somewhere. There is a policy and procedure somewhere that says those.
Yeah. They're delegated to the chief credit officer and to a series of investment officers in the investment department who have allowed to. Invest up to those amounts of money. The investment department has its own investment committee or committees, and a series of them that are the responsible body to approve them. So they go through that whole thing. And we control some of it by something we call our CSC alert lists, where if we see a credit exposure that we don't, concerned about, we put it on the alert list as a concern or a concentration or something that of that nature.
Sure. I mean, one of the things we'll get to in a little while is, of course, we've seen all these credit committee memos for CDS that were written by FB that indicate that varying levels of authority may have to approve the deal, whether it's just the committee or
that's
the CRO or the CEO or whatever. I don't know if we have it, but if AIG hasn't, and I don't know who this gets directed to, but we'd like to see the policies and procedures that set out what the delegated authorities are for both FP and the securities lending business and whether it changed over time. That would be helpful. One quick question in the back that I forgot to ask. In July of 2004, when the ERM function is set up, how come? Any precipitating event for that?
Not that I recall. No, I think it was just that the decision was made. I think one of the motivations behind it was to set up an operational risk management department, and I think they felt that they needed to. Leading practice at that time was to have a chief risk officer and to change to have an ERM, and it was the first time the word enterprise risk management was used at AIG. And I think it was really that to kind of get into conformity with some of the better practices around in the industry.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Who is in charge of risk management over the credit book at AIG FP? So starting with your knowledge in July 2004.
Bill Wallace at that time was the chief credit officer of AIG FP.
And how long was he there? Or in that function?
He was... he was chief credit officer before I even joined at AIG in 1999. So he went back quite a ways. I don't know the exact starting date that he had. But.
And then going forward, when would he?
He will be replaced, I want to say, in the summer of 2005 by Ed Diaz, D-I-A-Z. Formal name is Eduardo Diaz Perez. And Ed will replace him. I will interview Ed as part of the process of hiring him, and he's brought in around the summer of 2005.
Had Mr. Diaz been at AIG before, or did he came in?
No, he came from
function.
Morgan Stanley, as I remember.
Okay. And who was the chief risk officer of AIG FP?
I don't think there was a chief risk officer at that point of AIG FP. subsequently, and Pierre Makatis will become the chief risk officer, but I'm not sure exactly when that was.
But it was after July of 04.
Yeah, I want to say it's July, after July of 04.
And would the chief credit officer at FP have reported to the chief risk officer at FP? Do you know how that would have worked?
The chief credit officer or the chief risk officer?
Would the chief credit officer have reported to the chief risk officer, or would they have been
Well, later on, Diaz will report to Pierre Makatis, definitely. When Pierre Makatis comes into position, Ed Diaz will report to him, yes. At that point, when I think Ed is first hired, he's reporting to, what's his name, Doug Poling, who is the chief administrative officer of FP.
Poling was the chief administrative officer.
At that point, yeah.
All the acronyms.
I know.
It's hard to
get back to my days when I first got involved.
CCO.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, great. So I just want to walk through some of these credit review committee approval memos that we have seen for the, what I'm going to refer to, and tell me if you know this term or not, the multi-sector CDS portfolio at AIGFP. So we have a whole bunch of them, thanks to Stacey, and just want to walk through a few of them because I think it'll help us get an understanding for how the process worked. Mm-hmm. And we have some questions about some of them. So, and I have copies. I don't know. I think I have. I'm going to let you guys share one, and mm-hmm. if you wouldn't mind.
We can share one.
Okay. If I didn't distribute that right, just let me know. So you can take a minute to look over this if you want.
Do you want to mention that you've given them a November 16, 2004 for the record memo?
Thank you. I would have gotten there, but yes, this is a November 16, 2004 memo, transaction requiring approval, credit risk committee asset purchase from Merrill Lynch Capital Services LP in respect of the senior most tranche of Jupiter High Grade CDO LTD. It's bait stamp AIG FCIC 0052241 through 522439. Does this look familiar to you?
Yep. Yes, it does.
Does this particular one look familiar, or does the format look familiar?
The both, but the since we've done some Odyssey reviews of some of these transactions, so both. So I don't remember this particular one precisely, but yes.
Was this the standard form for approving these transactions? The multi-sector.
I wouldn't say there was
CDS?
A standard form, but this is. I would say this is rather typical. Yeah.
Would all of the multi-sector CDS transactions have been written up and approved, or only ones that exceeded certain thresholds?
A little more complex answer to that question. Generally, the size of most of the transactions of the multi-sector CDO portfolio would exceed their delegated authority, even for AAAs. And these transactions are, you know, as you know, rated super AAA. So by and I think their authority at this point for a AAA is $250 million, but I may be wrong on the amount. But generally, the vast majority of the CDS exposures, whether multi-sector CDOs or regulatory capital ones or corporate arbitrage ones, which are all part of FP's business, virtually all of them come downtown for a counter approval.
And would you have been the person approving the transactions?
For most of the multi-sector CDO portfolios, I was not directly the primary signatory on it.
I'll just note that this is the cover page of the memo is to you.
Correct. It generally was reviewed and signed off by two of my officers, John Weibel, who is in charge of the FP portfolio, and Barbara Levino, who is head of my financial institutions group, who would be the second signature.
What was the second name?
Livanou, L-I-V-A-N-O-U. Barbara is the first name.
And she was the head of what?
Our financial institutions group.
So do we see those names anywhere on this memo?
You don't. You don't have the signed copy of the approval.
I bet we could find.
But you, if you did, you would see those names. Now, I want to be careful here. There are some that I do sign, but there are the vast majority of them I don't. Now, and if I may, I might as well just throw this into it. The credit committee of AIG, the credit risk committee, met every 2 weeks generally. And we produce as part of the committee, the typical committee agenda will be things such as approval of the minutes of the previous meeting, a review of the approval log, and that would be all the approvals that have been granted by the members of CRM. And so it would include these very approvals. Am I saying something?
No, I'm just telling Stacy, without trying to interrupt you, that we want the approval logs and the approvals of the reviews of the approval logs.
I open my mouth and this is what happens.
Yes.
we actually already asked for that.
Yeah,
so.
Not to worry.
And then the other items would be things like a review of the portfolio reviews. Not all members of the credit risk committee could attend the CRC portfolio reviews, so we would always review the minutes of the meeting that we had with the various units with them.
So just so I can, I'll just let you know, I actually have a set of the CRC mm-hmm. minutes that we'll go through in a little bit.
Sure.
So
you've seen a little bit of the
we've seen
process.
A few.
Right.
We don't have a lot, but we've seen a few. So we can show that to you in a bit and go through that. So just to focus back on the approval memo,
mm-hmm.
You said that you would sign some of them. Mm-hmm. Was there a reason why you might sign some? Was it based on
people were out of the office, vacations, mostly that. There was also a requirement that anything, I don't think it falls into the domain, except for one transaction that I can think of, in the multi-sector CDO portfolio, anything at the $5 billion or higher number would have to be approved by me personally. That was AAA rated.
$5 billion or higher.
Yeah, and there was one transaction that happens fairly early on, which is a CDO of AAA-rated CMBS called Max, and that transaction I will approve, and in fact has to go to the CEO and is subsequently approved by Hank Greenberg himself.
So if it exceeded a $5 billion threshold, it had to be approved by you. Would it also have had to have been approved by the CEO?
Yes.
At that threshold level?
Yes.
And just to, I hope, close out the loop. You mentioned you thought the limit was $250 million for the folks at FP, and I assume that limit was for folks like Frost and Forster.
Yes, it was for the whole. It was for the group as a group. It was not for any particular individual. It was for FP itself.
And so, anything over $250 had to be signed off on by two credit committee members,
correct.
Credit risk committee members.
Correct.
Okay.
And then I would review part of my protocol with the. With the credit committee is I would review the log and would review those transactions that we're talking about here today with the members of the credit committee.
And when you had your credit risk committee meetings and you're reviewing the approval log, are you actually reviewing the memos?
No. I'm outlining some key information within the memos, but not the memos themselves. So I will refer to the amount, probably the subordination level, the kind of collateral, the worst case average rating factor in the transaction, the worst case VAR that's in the transaction relative to the attachment point. I might go into some things like any concentrations of single obligors, issues of that type.
When these memos that are addressed to you, if they're not over the $5 billion cutoff that specifically requires your approval, do you review them or do they just get farmed out?
I am reviewing them as part of my preparation for the CRC committee, okay. So I certainly knew this was going on.
Okay.
That's the nature of your question.
So if you could just turn to the second page, there's a box in the bottom right-hand corner that I think Chris was referring to about the sign-off on the by the CRC members.
Right.
On the left-hand side, it says limit in excess of house limit, and then it calls for signatures by Howard Smith and Robert Lewis on this particular form.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that there? What limits would there have been that would have required Robert Lewis?
This is a standard approval form for all our credit exposures around the company. This is not just for the,
okay.
Yeah, correct. And anything, we had a series of house limits that were set by risk rating, and any things above the house limits had to go to and be approved by either Bob or by Howie Smith.
Do you remember what the house limits were?
They will no. They will. They will. They will. They're for certain asset classes, and they will. They will. They will change over time. But I can't. I think the AAA one was. I think, in fact, $5 billion, as I recall. I forget exactly the amounts, but.
So anything under $5 billion only required approval by two creditors?
Well, no. I mean, if something was rated, something was rated a triple B.
Senior.
Yeah. If anything was rated a triple B, the amount would be much lower.
Sure.
And so I think the triple B authority, the house limit, was something like $1 billion or $1.25 billion.
And when you talk about the rating, I mean, are we talking about the rating of super senior tranche, which is always above the AAA tranche? Are we talking about the ratings of the underlying reference collateral?
We're talking about the super senior CDO rating.
The super senior book that all the losses came out on and caused all the problems, for that book then, anything under $5 billion would have only required the approval of two credit risk committee members?
That is correct.
And
the vast majority, with the exception of one, I can't think of any others that would have gone beyond the two members of the credit committee, the credit of CRM that approved it.
What was the composition of the credit risk committee? Who was on it?
It was.
And if you could give names, great, and also sort of functional positions.
Well, it changes because, as you know, we have management changes. But essentially, it's the CFO. Initially, Howie Smith was succeeded by Steve Bensinger. It is the treasurer, which becomes Bob Gender, and before that was Steve Bensinger. This is during my tenure now.
Of course.
The controller, which was David Herzog at this stage. The chief risk officer, Bob Lewis, the head of financial services, Bill Dooley, who will be, that doesn't change. The head of AIG Investments, Wynn Neuger, the head of the fixed income portfolio, which is Richard Scott. Who am I missing?
FP.
No, there's no one from FP on the committee. And then there'll be members of my team, which is myself as chairman of the committee, John Weibel, Barbara Levenel herself, who is also the secretary of the committee, and the head of my international side, who effectively replaced me, if you will, Mike McWalters, who joins us in January of 2005. That, I think, is everybody.
And so do all of those people?
And by the way, the CEO is sort of an ex officio member and gets copies of the minutes of the CRC. From time to time, I would be called up by the CEO and asked about it, asked questions about it.
Of the CRC minutes, he gets copies.
Yeah, he gets copies.
But not of these approval memos.
No,
not
of the
approval
memos.
That was my question.
Yeah. Oh, also, at this point, I mean, early on, a significant person who's on this, on the committee, too, is Ed Matthews, who is, I don't remember Ed's exact title, but Ed will leave in March 2005 when Hank Greenberg departs from the company. But Ed was sort of in charge of, I don't remember Ed's title, but he was in charge of, he was a senior advisor, if you will, to Greenberg.
Okay. Right. Do you know who would have prepared these memos for review by the Credit Review Committee or Credit Risk Committee? Review Committee.
Who prepared them? I think the two individuals who would be here and...
But your knowledge of the preparation from them comes just from the prepared byline.
That's correct. Right.
Would you ever have called them and asked them questions about any individual transactions? So, for example, here on the third page of this document, it's Alan Frost, Gary Gordon, and Andrew Forster.
Yeah, I will raise questions with Gary Gordon from time to time. Was probably our primary contact around these multi-sector CDOs. We'll talk somewhat about the modeling parts of the transactions. John Weibel had extensive conversations with him at times, and so there was an active dialogue, I think, that was taking place, more probably at John's level than it was at mine.
What questions about the model would you have had for Mr. Gordon?
Well, we were trying to understand the models themselves, not just regard, because remember, this is a segment of a much larger portfolio, which is including regulatory capital transactions, which is European first lien mortgages,
sure.
and small and medium enterprise SME loans, and corporate bond portfolios, we call it the corporate arbitrage portfolio. So we were sometimes talking to Gary about positions there. We had one European mortgage transaction which had a lot of second lien product in it and had a lot of East German mortgages, and East Germany was going through a tough time at the time that was downgraded by the rating agencies, and we would we talked to him about that particular transaction, which was at that point the only one that was not AAA rated still. So things of that type, and where his models were indicating that the worst case VARs had now exceeded the attachment point, the AAA attachment points.
These were particular points. Transactions that had exceeded the attachment points?
That particular one had at one point, yes.
So this wouldn't have been as part of the approval process.
This would have been ongoing monitoring, right? Correct. They were sending me down. They were sending me down, and I would review it as well. Regular quarterly memos on the super senior portfolio, in which they list all the transactions down, describe for me. And this was really the memo itself was the basis of a meeting they had up at FP of the credit team. Combined with some of their trading people, Andy Foster usually was participating. I think Joe Cassano might have even participated in some of those meetings. And the product of those meetings would be some memos that they would send down on a quarterly basis to tell me about the trends in this book.
Stacy, I think we've also that's also one in process, correct?
I'm not sure. Well, we're specifically referring to.
We can talk about it later.
Yeah.
We can talk about that offline. Okay.
I'm sorry, just quick. Understanding who the members of the Credit Risk Committee are when you guys have your meetings every 2 weeks, I think you said, right?
At this stage, yeah.
Right. This stage being?
Well, we'll move to a monthly, we'll move to a monthly rotation sometime in, I think in 2007, from 2 weeks, every 2 weeks to every month.
Does it ever get more frequent than a month?
No.
Okay.
No. And usually not. I mean, once in a while we might have something in 3 weeks or something, but it would be.
Right. And I know we'll see this in the minutes, but generally are folks from FP attending the meetings?
No, not generally.
So it's just the committee members in the
meeting? Just the committee members, right.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
From time to time there might be special requests for somebody to attend the meeting, but that didn't happen with any frequency.
Did you ever attend the quarterly meetings at FP?
No.
So if you wouldn't mind walking through this a little bit and explaining to me what, when you're reviewing a transaction, would have been most important to you in looking through this from a credit perspective.
Well, I think, the focus would have been in many of these transactions was, of course, first we were always writing generally the Class A1 notes. So that would be the first point. We would always look for issues of whether or not the A2 notes, which is the one level below, what ratings those were by the rating agencies. We would look at the attachment points, which is this percentage buffer number here, called 19.5, which is the subordination against that super senior position. That's what AKA's attachment point is. It's just a technical term.
So here, 19.5%
correct
is the attachment point, and the super senior part would be under the column percentage of cap structs, cap STR, capital structure, I presume?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's absolutely right. We'll look at the originator of the deal. We'll look at issues as to whether or not this was a managed or static transaction. Static means, of course, that there's no replacement of the collateral. It just stays in place. Managed means that the manager has the right to substitute within certain parameters.
So if I could take you back just one second, mm-hmm. I want you to keep going, but you said the originator was one of the things you would have looked at. Mm-hmm. On this one, is the originator, would that be Merrill? Is that what you're referring to? I think on the first page it...
I believe that's right.
The second page is an obligor name.
On page 2?
Yeah, or even if you look at the page one here, it says purchase from
Merrill. Maryland, yeah.
So that would have been what you're referring to as the originator.
Yeah, I believe them. Yeah, well, not necessarily, because sometimes the originator and the counterparty are two different names, but I think in this one, it's one and the same.
Okay, so I apologize, and then you were...
No.
So, for example, if Merrill was the originator, would that have signal to you a good thing?
Yes, generally, Merrill was a respected count originator in this particular business. Yes.
Were there any that would have given you concern?
I know that generally FP did a review of the originators, so we generally did not have. I don't recall having a lot of reservations about most of the names that we ran into.
Okay.
Generally, pretty respected parties in this business, generally, at that time at least.
And presumably, the traders or the credit people at FP have done some due diligence in advance.
Correct.
Of putting this together right. for your
yeah,
review.
Remember, we're a second line of defense on this, so this is pretty much now we're going through asking questions and reviewing some of the key items here.
So I think the next thing you had mentioned was whether the deal was static or whether it was
managed.
Yeah. Okay.
And the managed significance is obviously the manager has the ability to replenish collateral.
And where is that shown on here?
If you go to the description of CDO assets and liabilities, it says the CDO will acquire a static portfolio of collateral.
Okay. Were there other criteria that would have been important to you?
We always would look at this particular section, which would be basically what the collateral was.
This is what it's called, structured asset classification?
Correct.
Okay.
And we would look at that. We would look at the weighting average rating factor.
What would that tell you?
Well, it tells you the average quality of the collateral within the pool of the securities within the CDO. So in this particular case, the weighting average rating factor, which is on the last paragraph, second line, addition of the 10-year weighting average factor, is 41, which is roughly a low double A kind of collateral mix. My colleagues, I think, would look possibly at the diversity score, and then we would flip to, and then generally we'd always look at the worst case VAR information, which is on the last page of the narrative, and the analysis that we would read, of course, the whole thing. And so I don't want to give you the impression that it was just we were just skimming through it. But in all these transactions, my credit executives would all go through it, and they would compare the different worst case attachment VARs against the attachment point. This particular case, as you can see, for all the scenarios that they've outlined, it's well below the attachment point on the front page of 19.5%.
Mm-hmm. So back to the
going back to that period, probably the impression would be that it was a relatively safe transaction.
Dixie, can I ask something else? Would one of your data points also be the nature of the underlying assets referenced in the CDO? For instance, there's a table there that says...
There's a table in the back, and certainly I would look at this as to the ratings here, yes. And certainly the number of securities within the pool.
Right, the number of obligors.
Correct.
And what about the type of asset class, whether it was RMBSA whether it was RMBS mid-prime, whether it was RMBS subprime, RMBS Alt-A.
So I think that actually goes back to this table, the structured asset classification table?
Correct.
Yeah, that's the summary, and then the annex, it lists all CUSIP.
Right.
That,
well, as you know,
as
you know, a lot of these terms are the kind of technical terms, and oftentimes what they're talking about in A and B and C is not so much the collateral as it is the tranche. So you could have, for example, an RMBS C and a prime, a tranche C and an RMBS prime transaction, or you could have a tranche C and a subprime transaction. So you don't always know that going into it. But as you say, where you can glean that better is by looking at the ratings that are right here on the last page. Is that clear?
Yeah, no, I understand.
So if you go back to the structured asset classification table, it says RMBS A,
right.
And it's got the amount, and then it's got the percent of existing portfolio.
Right.
And I guess the paragraph above says to date approximately 59.4% of the portfolio has already been purchased. So would this table only have been for that part that's already been purchased?
That is correct. I believe that's what that says. Yes.
There's
a ramp-up period. So it ramps up and it stays in, you know, as a static transaction. Once it ramps up to its full amount, it stays static and then it drops.
So on the table, RMBS A, for example, is 13.64% of the current portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
RMBS BC is currently 33.65%. What is the difference between RMBS A and RMBS B/C?
That is usually the tranche level that's referring to of the deal.
I don't understand. Could you explain a little
bit
more?
Well, a tranche level means it's you have, if you go to the front page and you look at this, you see a class 1A, class 1B, that's referring to, that if you see RMB BC, it's referring to those lower classes of securities.
Okay, so this isn't referring, for example, to prime or subprime.
You cannot make, right, correct, you can't make that direct equivalence from BC to subprime. That's not necessarily the case.
I beg your pardon. I guess I've sampled quite a bit of the CUSIP numbers, and I pull them up.
A lot of them,
they're subprime.
I don't mean to say that a lot of them are not. That's not what I mean to say. It's just I'm just trying to be careful with terminology. That's all. Because you can have a B and a C transaction as part of a higher quality.
Of course, you could have a B and C RMBS that could be AAA rated.
Correct. No, I'm not disagreeing.
And it could also be prime.
It could also be prime, right.
So that's my question, is if I'm trying to interpret this, which obviously I am, if I have RMBS A, that could be subprime or prime. It's just the class A note of a residential mortgage-backed security.
That is correct. But as your colleague is saying, that a lot of this was indeed subprime.
So even in the RMBS A line, it could have been subprime.
Yes.
Is there anything in these memos that would have told you a breakout of subprime versus prime?
Not in this memo.
Not in this one. Perhaps in others?
There are some in others, yes.
Do you know if your credit folks actually drilled into the CUSIPs to sample what was being represented?
I don't know, but I don't believe they did.
So from the credit...
Actually,
nope.
Any reason why that didn't occur? Since, I mean, it's easy with 2020 hindsight now, you know, to look back. But, you know, as Al was saying, you know, we have drilled down into a lot of the CUSIPs, and a lot of this was subprime and, frankly, you know, stuff that you would think on the surface when you see RMBS A, despite what you said, and you think of the prime, was not. So I'm just curious about, I mean, I take it was not a policy to do that.
No, that's right. And I think, again, you know, it's hard to, this is now 6 years ago you're talking about, and at this time the attention to this issue is simply not there. And I think in reality folks were just looking at the quality of the ratings that were the securities that were in there, as opposed to what was would later become the issue of subprime, Alt-A's, prime. Nor do you have in this whole discussion, you can get into other areas. Was it a subprime ARM or subprime fixed rate? You know, all the things I think that have come to the forum, the forefront, of course, of all our consciousness at this point is not going on at this stage of the game at all.
So I'm just going to show another credit review committee memo, sort of as a point of reference.
Give that back to you?
You can hold on to it if you want. That's right. So this one is dated May 12, 2006, AIG FCIC 00384048 through 384056. And this one, the regarding line says transaction requiring approval, credit risk committee, asset purchaser credit derivative with Goldman Sachs International in respect of the senior most tranche of Hout Bay 2006-1 LTD, the CDO. So just as sort of a point of comparison, if you go to the structured asset classification table, the Bates number is 384051 down at the bottom
page
of the page.
Is this what this?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
So here, there are several more asset classes broken out.
Right.
You have ABS CDO, you have CMBS CDO, which I presume is commercial mortgage-backed security?
That's correct.
CMBS conduit, CLO, and then you have four RMBS categories,
right.
Agency, prime, Alt-A, and BC, and
right.
then student loan.
Right.
So here, what would the RMBS B/C have told you? I guess I'm asking since the other categories are agency, prime, and Alt-A. So I'm wondering if that would be more a true representation that that's subprime or?
Probably yes, would be my answer to that. This is the very last transaction that is done.
That contains subprime, yes,
yeah,
I'm aware of that.
Exactly. You got the good one. And
well, I guess
so
that depends how you look.
Absolutely fair. Absolutely fair point. But the. But as you can see here, now you're getting a little bit more texture in the type of collateral. Yes.
So that was actually one of my questions: was this type of more detailed breakout something that the credit risk committee, credit review committee, apologize, asked for? Was this something that? Well, I'll stop there.
A little background, I guess, to that question is certainly, I would say, certainly was stuff, information I was looking for, certainly, yes. As I'm reviewing the credit committee log and taking the credit committee members through the whole portfolio, I began to get, and also I was doing more review around the mortgage books, particularly the mortgage market generally, and I was getting a little apprehensive about some of the mezzanine transactions that are starting to build up. And by mezzanine, I mean CDOs primarily with triple B kinds of collateral in them.
So, could you give us a little bit of a time frame around when you started thinking about
late
these
fall
issues?
Of 05, early? I would say it's probably I'm starting to do more review around issues like this.
And what prompted? Would it have been something in the broader world? Would it have been the fact that there
was... It was just more the volumes of issuance that I was seeing coming from FP, the volumes that were going through the market generally. Just general observations about what is going on in the credit market, that it was starting to build up some, you might say, steam here in the mortgage market generally. And I'm starting to look at the whole question of what, you know, potentially are we on the edge of a potential bubble? I mean, I'm not sure that we are, but I'm starting to at least ask questions. Ultimately, I will be in London in March, and we'll sit down with Joe Cassano and and some of his credit team and talk about my anxiety about specifically about the mezzanine transactions.
In March of 2006.
That's correct. Now, the mezzanine collateral, as you know, mezzanine transactions, you know, a typical triple B RMBS may have anywhere from 7 to 8% subordination within it. And so the whole question becomes, you know, the only experience that the market had had it up to this point is probably around 2000 when losses were about 5.5-6%, something in that range. So it's not looking like it's, you know, the triple B's are yet in jeopardy, but I'm starting to get apprehensive, and we're doing a lot of this. So I have a conversation with Cassano, and he tells me at that point, as I recall, that they had they were slowing the pipeline down. They were going to get out of the mezzanine side of the business, or I think they already had, or he said tells me they already had. I don't remember the exact conversation. So I leave somewhat more comforted by that, and subsequently they send me a formal notice that effectively they are getting out of the mezzanine business.
When would they have sent you a formal notice?
Sometime in March of 06, I believe.
Did you have any conversations with Joe Cassano or anyone else at FP before March of 2006 about FP getting out of this business?
Not that I recall, no. I may have asked some, you know, more questions about just trends and mortgage trends, which I don't recall those specifically, but no, I wasn't. I didn't talk to Cassano explicitly about this until that March conversation. At least I don't recall I did.
When you refer to mezz deals or mezzanine mm-hmm. deals, is that one of the ways that I've heard that referred to is in contrast to something called a high-grade deal?
That's correct. The one that you first showed me was a high-grade deal. High-grade meaning the collateral was primarily single A and better collateral.
So the underlying collateral in the CDO.
The underlying collateral, correct.
Was there a point in time you said you noticed that FP was starting to do a higher volume of deals and more mezzanine deals? Do you remember when you would have noticed them doing more mezzanine deals?
You know, it's hard to precisely remember. They were doing more transactions, so certainly that was a bit of a red flag.
They're doing more of everything.
More of everything. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this was, if you were to look at the approval logs, the volumes of all kinds of business, including regulatory capital and corporate arbitrage, were also high. But I certainly, the mezzanine stuff sort of more stuck in my craw, I guess you might put it, more than anything else, and that's what led me to chat with Cassano about it. But I can't. If you're asking about the distribution between mezzanine and high grade, and I don't recall that being, you know, a particular focus of mine at that time, at least. I think I was more focused on just the volumes, especially the growth in absolute dollar amounts, if you will, of the mezzanine transactions.
Do you recall why there was such an increase in growth in 2005? I'll tell you, I mean, we see that at the end of 2004, the super senior portfolio is about $17 billion. It's like $54 billion at the end of 2005, so you've got a tripling of that.
Not explicitly. I mean, it was markets were active. There were a lot of issuance going on, and FP was trying to take advantage of it. They were in business to make money.
Sure. Let me ask you this: in March of 2005, of course, Mr. Greenberg leaves,
right,
and the credit rating is downgraded for AIG.
Correct.
Do you have any memory bells about reasons, perhaps, why the volume went up? Did it have anything to do with Mr. Greenberg?
Not at all. In fact, this was a business that was well cranked up already by, as you say, by the time he leaves, and you know, it's fully, you know, Smith and Matthews are sitting on that committee. They know what's going on. There's no indication that it should slow down in any way.
Do you recall any discussions at that time about the fairly substantial increase in volume on the super senior book?
Other than what I just expressed as my own concern, no. There was no one else really, you might say, that I'm aware of that had anxiety about the growth.
And that's the case throughout 2005?
Yes.
Okay. I thought I heard you say towards the fall of 2005 you had concerns about the level of mezzanine.
I started to get some anxiety, yeah, about that point.
But other than yourself, you don't recall anybody having anxiety about
I don't.
The growth or composition of the super senior book?
No.
Okay. It's our understanding that at some point in late 05, Mr. Park takes over the super senior book from Mr. Forster. Is that
Mr. Frost.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
Forster. Forster.
Is that your understanding?
No. I just don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear that Mr. Park had any concerns about the super senior book?
I did not.
Have you read The Big Short?
I have.
Have you seen the, then you know that at well, least Michael Lewis is reporting that Park had concerns about the super senior book in the summer.
The only contact I had with Gene Park was at one point FP will ask to potentially play in the trading way in a small amount of equity tranches. In of CDOs, of multi-sector CDOs, $25 million. It, because of the nature of being an equity piece, I was asked to review it. And I believe I reviewed, this was I think early, sometime early in 05, and I believe I reviewed it with Park by email or verbally, I don't recall how. But that's really the only time I ever really had that much contact with Gene.
Was there any change in how the super senior book was monitored by AIG corporate after Mr. Greenberg left?
Any change in protocol? No. I mean, the same reports are coming down. Monthly reports, because FP had produced a monthly financial report or a series of metrics that they had. They would list information that would go to a broad audience. I think it might be. I don't remember how high up it went. I was reading it myself. But no, there were no changes in protocol per se that I recall.
There's been some reports in the financial press that Mr. Sullivan canceled biweekly meetings that Mr. Greenberg held to review. I don't think just FP, but just all of the investments at the company. Do you recall anything
no,
like that happening?
I don't.
Do you recall that there were biweekly meetings with Mr. Greenberg when he was there?
I do not. I certainly was not a member of that. Was not in those meetings.
Do you know if they occurred?
I don't.
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
I want to ask just a couple more questions about this memo. And one is, I pointed out earlier that there were four categories of RMBS securities underlying this portfolio, the CDO portfolio. And if you add them up, I think it's roughly something like 75%. Would concentrations have been something that would have concerned you? So, for example, concentration in RMBS been something that the credit committee would have been concerned with or looking at? And if so, how would you deal with that?
Certainly, we would take note of it, and I would at the credit meetings when I would take people through the transactions, I would specifically list what not only what percentage of it that you just referred to, but I would actually list what I knew about it, meaning the breakdown between prime, alt-A, subprime, if we had the information, or RMB. So I would go through those metrics with the committee. The answer to that is yes.
Did any of these memos or deals that would have been written up in these memos, to your memory, get denied?
I can't answer that categorically one way or the other. I would say the vast majority were approved. But I can't tell you whether or not we kick back any at all. We may not have. I just don't recall the exact facts. I think it's, you have to remember the context for a lot of what's going on here, and that is that at this stage of the game, there's not a lot of anxiety yet in the market about the buildup in the general mortgage issuance. We took a little bit of pride, I think, in the fact that we stopped doing this when we did. And we were one of the first major houses that did. Others continued. And that would become some anxiety of my own with regard to other financial institutions, actually, to whom we extended credit in the bond portfolio, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
So we always thought that, you might say, our perception of it at that point was we stopped in the nick of time, so to speak, and we didn't. That's why, while the volumes are very large, there's no question about that, we took some comfort in the fact that we stopped when we did.
Did the notional amount, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say to Kevin to clarify his answer to your last question a little bit. You might want to tell Dixie a little bit about how there is often a conversation between FP and corporate about the proposed transaction before the memo actually gets to them. So, you know, I don't know because I wasn't at FP, but it may be the case that they're not sending the transactions up unless they think there's already a pretty good likelihood it's going to get approved.
That's a very good point, because Gary Gordon would often call John Weibel and explain he had a deal and he wanted to move it relatively quickly because the counterparty was asking for relatively rapid, and he would take him through the key facts of the case. So there was a good amount of telephone conversation going on around a lot of these transactions.
Was it your understanding that Mr. Gordon was involved in the multi-sector CDS transactions through 2004 to 2006? Do you know? You said that Gary Gordon would have been...
His name is on the memo. So I certainly was aware that Gary was working on it. So, yeah.
So I think back to something that you had said just a bit ago about you were aware that the size of the transactions was large and that the volume was increasing at a rapid pace. Did the notional size of the book itself ever give you pause? Was there ever any sort of limit on the... I think that it...
No, there was not the answer.
It got up to something like $80 billion in notional amount?
It got into 80... I think the actual peak is 81, as I recall, of which about 19 of it is not stuff with subprime in it. It's got prime collateral, or it's got CMBS. The max transaction I was referring to earlier was a big part of that. It was $5 billion. Or more, I forget the exact amount. I think it was more than five, because Greenberg had to sign off on it. But the, but no, I wouldn't say that when it hit that amount that there was anything. I mean, we knew the amounts were high, but there was nothing that there was no exact limit that was imposed on the multi-sector CDO book. It wasn't like if it gets to $100 billion, stop, kind of thing.
So as I understand it, the FP had a whole bunch of derivatives businesses. It had interest rate derivatives, it had equity derivatives, it had currency derivatives, and it had credit derivatives, among others, I'm sure. And that most of AIGFP's derivative books were fully hedged. But the credit book was not hedged. Is that your understanding? Or did you know that at the time?
I don't know, you know, I don't want to go into a discipline I don't know that much about, which is the question of whether they were hedging the commodities book, hedging the equity book, hedging, you know, the various positions they were taking. I was aware there was some hedging being done in the credit book that we did, mostly that was on the regulatory capital side. So it's not fair to say that none of the credit exposures were ever hedged. I think that's not quite factually correct. But I don't recall there being a lot of hedging around the multi-sector CDO book, if that's what the nature of your question.
So I don't want to take you. I'm not asking you to answer questions that you don't know the answer
to. Right.
But I am curious why, or if it was ever considered, whether the credit book should be hedged. It goes to the whole point about how big the book can get. I mean, could it get to $1 trillion? Could it, would that ever, I mean, at some point,
there was a conversation that we would have. What would happen was, after we stopped writing multi-sector CDO business, as you know, we would continue to do regulatory capital business. I become very involved in this particular business.
It
had to do with the fact that John Weibel had taken sick, and I And also the numbers of these, the dollar amounts of these transactions were very large. They were, you know, we had one transaction that got as high as, I think, $18 billion. So it was stuff that I had to look at anyway. So there's a lot of Q&A going on, a lot of questions going back and forth. I'm asking them to run different stress tests against different things. There becomes a point in which Cassano does want to do more regulatory capital trades, taking advantage of what now has become a nervous market. This is around the 07 period. And we do, and the book now is in the $450 billion range. I'm going through rough numbers. Mm-hmm. You can probably get these from our financial reports. And there is a conversation with Martin Sullivan and Steve Bensinger about how high is high. And Martin does, I think, impose a cap of some sort. And I want to say it was around 550, something in that range. I forget from memory. On the entire CDS book, the entire super senior business. And so, which is not everything Cassano wants, but serves as that cap. And that's done, I think, sometime in September of 07, I want to guess, something around that period of time.
Does Cassano want to increase the reg cap book because of the decision to stop writing the super senior CDS?
I think he's trying to make some money, and I think it's...
Course.
You know, I don't know if that's cause and effect. That's enough to say he stopped one and doing something to pick up on the other, but certainly he was trying to write more bonds.
But was that the timing? Or was it the O?
Well, no, because you're talking about a year, almost 15, 16 months later. Mm-hmm. He's stopping in the first quarter of 06, and he's, we're now in September of 07, so I don't know, I don't recall,
I'm sorry. I understand that September of 07 is when Mr. Sullivan says, all right, we're going to put a hard cap of 550 or whatever it is for all credit derivatives. I was asking something a little different. Do you know if perhaps 18 months earlier, when the decision's made to stop writing on the super senior tranches because of the concern about the subprime market, that there is then an effort to ratchet up the reg cap book?
I don't know that precisely, no.
Okay.
No. I do know that we'll do more transactions through that period of time, but I also know that I'll put FP through some rigorous analysis around that book, which is, by the way, performed extremely well. It's not been an issue.
Right, exactly. I know just about all of the unrealized valuation losses have come on the super senior book.
Right.
Which leads to another question. When the anxiety is relieved, in 06, when FP stops...
Well, it's relief for a short period of time.
Right, I know. Eventually, the anxiety comes back, and out.
Yep.
But in this first quarter 06 time period, when they decide to stop writing on subprime super senior tranches, they don't hedge. We know that they never hedge that book. Do you recall any discussions about hedging that book and why the book was not hedged?
I don't recall there being anything until sometime in 07, by which time the market has dropped and becomes non-economic to do it, really. I think that was probably, at least it perceived at that point as being uneconomic.
And was the decision to hedge or not hedge something that was within the purview of the... what is this thing called? The Credit Risk Committee?
That would not necessarily be that decision. It would be more at a higher level. That would have been a more Sullivan Steve kind of decision.
Was the decision to hedge or not hedge the super senior book, was that something that would just be left to FP? Was it something that's dealt with under ERM with Bob Lewis? Or if you know, who makes that decision?
Well, I think, to put this in perspective, I think at this point we're still thinking that we may get a correction, but we're not thinking that this is going to be certainly as bad as it's turned out to be.
Sure.
I don't know explicitly. I mean, FP had its own board meetings, and I don't know whether there were discussions about hedging it at any of those board meetings. I don't recall a credit committee, which I think is a specific answer to your question, that discussion happening.
Okay.
one of the things that we now know is that there were collateral provisions in the CDS contracts for the multi-sector portfolio that required FPE to post collateral upon a number of scenarios, one of them being a decline in the mark-to-market value of the underlying assets. I don't see a description of any of the contractual terms in these memos, and so my first question is whether I've missed it, whether you're...
It's not in there.
It's not in there. Were you aware of the contractual terms on collateral posting in the CDS?
I was not.
Is that something that would have affected the analysis of the credit risk committee in approving or denying these deals?
Hard to say. I think at this period, certainly in the 04, early 05 period, probably not. No. I think it had even possibly had we known there were the CSAs in there, this seemed to be such a remote risk of happening. I don't know whether it would have actually influenced. Certainly we would have probably talked about it, but if we didn't, I don't know if it would have changed the outcome of the decision.
But there is
I'm speculating here. Hard to say.
So. And just for the record, when you say CSA, you mean credit support annex?
I do.
Okay.
Thank you.
There is a difference, though, between economic loss and a mark-to-market or unrealized loss, correct?
Correct.
And the attachment point that we talked about earlier that's listed in these memos would go to whether or not there was an expected economic loss.
That is correct. Credit.
Or a way to analyze.
The way I call it, credit loss.
Credit loss. Right. Or anticipate how likely it was that there would be a credit loss. If you could help me a little bit understand who at the company might have had or should have had the overall view of all the relevant aspects of the transaction, because there are quite a few aspects of the transactions that are included and described in these memos. The contractual provisions that I talked about were not one of them, and they ended up being a very significant issue that led to the demise of AIG, which is sort of why one of the things that obviously this commission is looking at. And if you could help me understand who at the company would have had that overall picture of how all the pieces work together, not just whether or not it was likely that there would be economic loss, but whether there could be other issues that would cause problems here, given the size of the notional amount of the book.
I don't know if I can answer that with any great sense of confidence. Bill Dooley obviously was in charge of the financial service division. Cassano reported to him, so certainly he might have some, need to have an overview of it. Within ERM, there were regular discussions between the market risk section of market risk department of ERM, run by Martin Mayer at that time, M-A-I-R, you guys are going to get me to spell for a living here. NFP. So hard to say. Who was responsible for the overall? Cassano was. The president of FP was, and his reporting line into the senior management at AIG. The business falls on the shoulders of Joe Cassano, I think, more than anybody else.
Did you have some questions on the investment criteria?
Yeah, just to follow up on what Dixie was highlighting about the collateral calls within the credit risk committee memo, along the same line. Can you elaborate on
the absence thereof? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I know that the Credit Risk Committee memo focused on credit risk, but I was wondering if there was anyone analyzing the market risk and the liquidity risk aspect of the transaction. Because when I look at the CRC memorandum and the supporting documentation, it looks like a transaction overview, a review of the transaction, a review of the risks. and it's focused on credit risk.
That is
but
correct.
I was wondering if there was anyone at the company looking at the market risk underlying the transaction or this business activity, and secondly, the liquidity risk of engaging in this activity. I was trying to see if, you know, to learn more about that, if you were able to comment.
Well, all I can tell you is that the liquidity risk is not part of VRM's department at this point, so I don't know who was in charge of that, if anybody was watching this store in that area. I can't really answer that. On the market risk side, I don't know. I was uniquely focused on the credit side of this business, and you know, that was my discipline. That was what I was primarily focused on. I don't know whether those anxieties or concerns or anything, or how that was managed within them.
Do you know if any of your analysts that were helping to prepare and had studied the transaction memorandum, if they had come to you and told you that RMBS mid-prime included subprime credit borrowers? Or do you recall any of that?
No.
What about, do you recall any one telling you that the RMBS home equity included bonds where the underlying collateral was subprime?
No.
Okay. Would you recalled if anyone that was reviewing the portfolio annex, if they have told you that RMBS A or RMBS Prime included all day collateral and mortgages backed by interest-only mortgages or payment option ARM mortgages?
No.
Okay. Because I can't say I've looked at all of them, because there's over 8,000 bonds in the
right.
40 credit memos that are sitting on my desk, but I've
right.
looked at quite a few, and I'll tell you that I've pulled a lot of the home equity deals, whether they're AAA, whether they're single A or BBB, and the home equity deals have weighted average FICO score of 600, 610, 620.
So
that's
subprime. Sure.
So it's not, it doesn't seem like it's characterized properly in the memo. And second, a lot of the RMBS A and the RMBS Prime is, I'm not going to say they're all like that, but of the ones that I've sampled, and I've sampled quite a few, they are all day private label
right.
RMBS, and some of them are really layered
yeah.
with risk.
Yeah.
So I've looked at some where entire portfolio in the trust is payment option mortgages, 45% of it's in California, 15% of it's investor property, and on top of that, they're in the capital structure that is the first to get wiped out after the equity. They're in the BBB minus Baa3 tranche. So do you recall if any one of the folks that worked for you, if they ever brought this to your attention?
No, they did not. And, you know, the only thing I can offer you there is that there has been, as you know, at this time, there was an awful lot of, I think, generally in Wall Street, some miscategorization is going on. We
yeah.
will find out as we go through this process, this painful process through 07, that as we boil down, we'll see that some of the things in the RMBS portfolio and the EIG investments portfolio, for example, that we thought was all day, turns out to be subprime, this kind of thing. As we pour deeper into the securities, you have to remember the function of the CRM. The function of CRM is not, we're not a credit audit function. We're not sitting there trying to second guess every single thing that is put on the printed page. We're basically trying to grapple with whether or not this is a reasonable transaction, being the second line of defense that we are. So that's the context for a department of the holding company.
Okay, just one more question. We noticed a lot of variability in the eligibility criteria for certain transactions, or actually for most transactions. Of the ones that we sampled in 04, they would have collateral eligibility criteria of, say, for example, that the collateral manager who's picking the portfolio cannot pick, the tranches have to be
yeah.
at least 70% AAA.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then some of them will be, it has to be at least 10% above,
yeah.
or AAA. 10%.
Yeah.
So, in other words, some of them are more liberal as far as the capital structure goes versus other ones.
Right.
And of course, that's that position on the capital structure that could influence the deal, whether you charge enough for writing protection on it or whether you lower it, you know.
And a lot of that is supposed to be.
Just one more thing. Yeah. And generally, I mean, again, we haven't looked at every one of these, but we tend to see a more liberal type of guideline when you go from 04 to 05, which of course corresponds with the huge growth of the portfolio. So I'm just wondering, do you recall if there was any, you know, decision back then that, you know, one of the ways we get more business is to loosen
the criteria? No, I don't remember that decision being, you know, being the case at all. And, you know, arguably the subordination is supposed to vary by the level of the quality of collateral that are in these transactions, obviously. So to do that, you know, scientifically, you have to almost compare that eligibility issue that you're talking about, which I don't take issue with, but compare it against what was happening with the attachment points. You know, the other thing that I become less, perhaps I should mention too, that what I become a little less confident about as time will go on is the worst case VAR methodology that is being used to analyze this particular group of securities, because the Gordon modeling is a heavily based rating agency corporate based transition model, and these are structured securities, and I become kind of uncomfortable with that, the use of that, and that becomes part of my dialogue with Cassano in March, that I do mention that to Joe, that, you know. So that becomes more a little bit more of an issue as well for me as I start pouring into the issue.
Well, let me actually follow up on that a little, because we know now anyway from looking at things that the company relies on either the VAR model or just the straight Gordon attachment point model until really the third quarter of 07. Mm-hmm. So if in the March of 06, 18 months beforehand, you're having conversations with Mr. Cassano about concerns about the modeling at the company, were there any discussions back then about getting a real valuation model?
Not that I recall. I mean, I'm pretty much focused on looking at what's going to be the probable lifetime losses to the subprime market, to the markets generally, both subprime and other kinds of collateral. And I'm not yet worried that our transactions at this point, okay, going into the 06, and I really don't get excessively worried about this until probably sometime, not excessively worried, but more concerned about it until sometime in 07. Because I don't see the losses climbing up into those attachment points, and there's enough, even though that, you know, a lot of the collateral is subprime, I'm still not. There is other kinds of collateral in these pools, so I'm not really at this point yet getting to the point where I'm worried about it.
So when you have concerns in March of 06, but not further concerns, do you know about the mark-to-market triggers and the contracts at that point?
I don't.
Okay. When do you find out about the mark-to-market triggers?
Sometime in the summer of 07. You're talking about the liquidity calls now?
Right, the collateral
yeah.
calls.
Yeah, I don't find out until the summer of 07.
Okay, any closer, I mean, June, July, August,
I don't.
Okay. Do you know if it was before or after the first collateral call came in?
I believe it was after.
July 26th, anyway.
I take your word for it.
So, yeah, according to the documents, I see. Did you also know that there were collateral call triggers based on downgrades of AIG's credit rating?
No.
And when did you find out about that?
Oh, I don't recall. I can't remember. I remember the issue at some point being raised by Elias Sabayev, who was the CFO of the Financial Service Division, but I don't remember the timing of that at all.
Okay. Do you recall if it was before or after you learned about the mark-to-market trigger?
It was after, definitely after.
Okay.
I think they want to take a quick break.
Oh, sure.
If you want to, if you wanted to finish a line of questioning, I didn't. Okay, we'll take a quick break.
Great, thank you.
Actually, we're going to leave you in here.